gambles don't always go as planned, especially when that gamble is gambling itself. In February 2009, Trump Entertainment Resorts filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection for the third time in a row, an extremely wow. rare feat in American business.
Congratulations, Donald.
So, Jazzy Ross, as we wrap up, what you think people around this country should understand about the participation of Native Americans in this election of 2016?
Well, I think that what we've shown in the past few elections and what we're going to continue to show is that, number one, our numbers are growing. And our willingness to participate, we have swung elections on a statewide level for national positions, in regards to here in Washington State, Maria Cantwell, in regards to John Tester, and those particular legislators will say that very openly and have been very open about the meaning of our votes to their elections, and we do have that power to impact national elections as well. In Nevada, had those precincts gone and had Bernie Sanders, actively courted the Native vote, I suspect there might have been a different outcome because that was a very close election. The point is that although it seems like, based upon my experience at Indian Country Today Media Network and collecting data for that publication, being an editor, that Native people have largely supported Bernie Sanders in this campaign, I don't think anybody can take our vote for granted. I think it is going to take a concerted effort for Democrats, who we historically vote for, to earn our vote, as opposed to just assuming that we're going to give it sight unseen as we have in the past. There's a younger generation that's very, very actively involved and very, very interested in these politics that say that you have to do something affirmatively, proactively, and progressively in order to earn the Native vote.
Jazzy Ross, we want to thank you for being with us, member of the Blackfeet Nation and an editor at Indian Country Today, author of How to Say I Love You in Indian. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We have three job openings.
All right. You are listening to KBOO. Portland. The time is 8:01. Up next is Positively Revolting.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Qualifier Sunday, February 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. There are three levels, beginner, intermediate, and advanced. Competition signups are available online at extremeamateurgames.com or on the day of the event at the park. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Qualifier, Sunday, February 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
They break our legs and we take back you with the offering creature. They break our legs and we say thank you.
And good morning. Good morning. It is about 3-4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and I think this is us starting now.
I believe so.
That is it. You are tuned to your very own community radio station, KBOO Portland, and you are listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning, we are very excited to have with us in the studio, John Perkins. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'm John.
Excellent.
Good to be here.
Places, everyone. Places. And we are excited to talk to John because, in fact, John is an author. He's written most recently, just out, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's out from BK Press. It's a revision and expansion of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which you wrote about 12 years ago. And I have to say, it hit me like a ton of bricks when I read it 12 years ago and is something I've often referred to since. So I'm excited to have this opportunity to talk to you this morning. Before you wrote that, you actually were a chief economist at a major international consulting firm where you advised major global economic forces like the World Bank, the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, governments around the globe. And in your role, you furthered what you've called global empire through arranging international development loans, which pay huge sums to private corporations and further are beyond the reach of most countries to repay those giant sort of unsupportable debt issues, leaving them vulnerable to needing to perform favors for investors. Can you further elaborate on that system that we've come to know as the economic hitman system?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this system has created the world's first truly global empire. It's a corporate empire, and we're seeing now that it's a failure. We've created a global economic system it's an absolute failure. In essence, we've created a death economy that's based on debt, fear, destroying the world, the resources of our planet. And the way that we did this, we economic hitmen, well, there's many ways, but perhaps the most common is that we would identify a country with resources our corporations want, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. The money, however, wouldn't go to the country. It would go to our own corporations, who would make a tremendous amount of money building infrastructure projects, power plants, highways, industrial parks, things that would benefit a few wealthy families in those countries. But
was that that's what aid? When we would talk about foreign aid, is that what foreign aid was?
Yeah, that's one aspect. These were usually big loans from the World Bank, not exactly aid in terms of grants, which sometimes the United States does give. And that's another, clandestine move to take over countries. But it's a little different than this, because this is these huge loans. And, you know,
that they know they'll never be able to repay.
Yeah, the people who take on the loans, the dictators, the heads of government know they won't be able to pay it back. But in paying off the interest, money is diverted from schools, from health care, from other social services. So the majority of the people actually suffer because of these loans. They don't benefit because they don't have enough money to buy much electricity. They can't get jobs in industrial parks because they don't hire many people. They don't have cars to drive on the highways. And yet, in the end, the country is left holding a huge debt that it can't repay. And so we go back at that point and say, hey, since you can't pay your debts, sell your oil or whatever the resource is real cheap to our corporations without any environmental restrictions or social regulations. Privatize. Sell your electric utility systems, your water and sewage systems, your schools, your jails, all your public sector businesses to our corporations. So really, in that way, we've created a global corporate empire. And it's turned out to be a failed global economic system, which we can get into more later.
And when you talk about those corporations that make huge profits from these loans and investments, those corporations are really familiar sounding. The corporations like Halliburton and Brown and Root.
Right. Mm-hmm. Bechtel, Stone & Webster, General Electric, Westinghouse, and all the big construction companies like International Harvester and John Deere and the oil companies, and Coca-Cola, who provides Coca-Cola to all the workers, and on and on and on.
Who needs water when you've got Coca-Cola?
And I saw Waste Management listed, which has a monopoly on, waste in the city. Love that. Currently there's an enormous amount of attention being put on the presidential election. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about this global empire, which really supersedes any one nation. Mm-hmm. So we were talking just before we went on the air, and I was hoping to
to get here soon in the conversation. This election, does it matter who wins really ultimately for the system, the global empire system?
You know, I can't say it doesn't matter because symbolically it has meaning. And the president may be able to do some things. We used to think the president had the right to appoint Supreme Court justices, but that's
quite the idea.
That's being questioned now, so I'm not sure. But the fact of the matter is that it's a diversion. The whole presidential thing. We need to understand that our president, our senators, and all of these people are truly slaves of the system and of the corporations who finance their campaigns. And, you know, even if we have a president who doesn't take any money from corporations, let's say in the end Bernie Sanders doesn't take any money and does get elected, he's going to be surrounded by people who have taken a lot of money, all the senators or most of the senators and Congress people, and over 100,000 people who are either lobbyists or acting as lobbyists. So we have to recognize that it's not our government. It's we the people. We have to take the power. We need to understand that. And I think the Obama election really showed that, because 8 years ago or so when he was running, there was this tremendous excitement. It was almost like some sort of a huge constant rally and almost like a music festival. And once he got elected, it all stopped. You know, the people went away and said, hey, we got the guy elected, now let him do the job. He can't. Nobody can. It's not his fault. It's not anybody's fault except ours. We've got to understand that we are the ones that have to take the action. And it's because we control the big corporations, ultimately. They only survive because we buy their goods and services, we invest in them, and we allow our tax dollars to support some very nefarious activities on their part.
So, and the other thing we were talking about before the show started was that folks don't care much about facts. Facts don't seem to change people's minds. Stories do.
Mm-hmm.
There's the story of capitalism, how great it is. The propaganda that's been going on in this country for a very long time about how great capitalism is, that seems to be eroding. A little bit.
Neo-capitalism, predatory capitalism, endgame capitalism.
The story that, America is the best place in the world and we are going throughout the world creating freedom for people. That story seems to be eroding. And then you were talking about news stories and how those are things that can help, and that you don't think it's that going to be that hard.
Well, I totally
to change imagination.
Yes. I learned years ago as a Peace Corps volunteer, working with indigenous people in the Amazon who overtly talk about basically two realities. And I certainly feel that today. There's these two realities. There's this microphone we're talking into. That's an objective reality. But what we talk about is really an imagined reality. So our cultures are imagined realities. Religion is an imagined reality. Countries are imagined reality. There's no natural United States or China or Russia. We've created these through concepts, and then we've codified it into law. So in fact, it has a huge impact. Our imagined reality has a huge impact on the objective reality. So our economy, what we've created, this death economy, is an imagined reality. The idea that corporations must maximize profits regardless of social and environmental costs is a pretty new idea. That's not what I was taught in business school in the late 60s.
Right,
that came
exactly
along in the 70s when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize by saying that. That's an imagined reality, and we can change that. So what we must do now is understand that this imagined reality of the system in the world, the economic hitman system, is a total failure. Just one example, less than 5% of us live in the United States, and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources while half the world's starving or on the verge of starvation. That's not a model. China, with 19% of the world's population, can't emulate that. Brazil can't. India can't. They're trying. They can't. We've got to understand that we must change that imagined reality and create what I call a life economy based on cleaning up pollution and regenerating destroyed environments and alleviating the causes of terrorism. That's the new reality. And I do think it's happening. People across the planet are getting it. And we just now need to continue to take actions that support this new reality.
What would you consider the causes for terrorism?
Well, I think for the most part, it's desperation. Yes, there are fanatics, and they're often wealthy people like Osama bin Laden. They're fanatics, but people follow fanatics because they're desperate. So if you just have totally lost faith in the system and you're desperate, you'll follow one of these fanatics. So to me, the way to alleviate acts of terror is to alleviate the deep-rooted causes, the desperation, the starvation, the wars, the destruction, the violence that goes on. And I think we need to recognize that there is no such thing as global terrorism.
Well, wouldn't you call austerity terrorism?
Yes, austerity.
Economic terrorism?
Yeah, it certainly is. It can lead to terrorism for sure. It's a policy that definitely leads to that. And we can, an ism is something where everybody shares principles, a common principles. So Catholicism, capitalism, socialism. These are isms. But I've talked to members of FARC in Colombia and Somali pirates and members of Al-Qaeda. They don't share any common principles. There's no ism. They all commit acts of terror, yes, but they're not united. And we're trying to convince the world that there's this ism out there, like communism, that we can attack on a global level. That just isn't the case. Every one of those people that I mentioned, every one of those organizations, FARC, Somali pirates, Al-Qaeda, they have different grievances, but they all, the people who are part of that, have very, very serious grievances. They're desperate for different reasons.
You mentioned Osama bin Laden briefly there for a moment. I want to step back for a second and look at the U.S. and Saudi Arabia's very close relationship that's developed over the last, 30, 40 years, exemplified really between the ties of the Bush family and the House of Saud. And you've written about that, as well as the $3.5 billion that were used between the U.S. and the House of Saud, Saudi Arabia, to fund the Mujahideen. And that, of course, being in the 80s as they were 70s, fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And can you sort of elaborate on that and draw forward into what we're looking at now with ISIS and how most people just find it unfathomable when you mention to them, you know, we the U.S. and our allies kind of help to, well, fund them and get them going. Can you elaborate on that?
Boy, how much time do we have?
Yeah, I know. This is going to be until noon, I think, but we're off the air at 9.
Well, yeah. You know, ISIS certainly has gained in power because of our involvement there. And you know, this goes back so far in history. I talk in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman about how back in the early 70s, OPEC launched an embargo against the United States and some of the rest of the world. And we have started to really destroy our economy. And the Treasury Department came to me and a few other economic hitmen at the time and said, hey, we can't let this happen again. Do something. Well, we knew that the something had to include the House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, because they were behind it. They were running OPEC, basically. And so to make a long story short, and the longer version's in the book, the final outcome was that the House of Saud agreed to return all of, or most all of its petrodollars to the United States by way of investing in U.S. Treasury securities. And the interest would be used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, to build petrochemical plants, desalination plants, and in fact, huge cities out of the desert, which we've done. And our corporations have made trillions of dollars in the process. And also, the House of Saud agreed that oil would only be traded for U.S. dollars, which put us on the petroleum standard. We just, in 1971, Nixon took us off the gold standard. So the dollar was floating around out there. By 73, we're on the petroleum standard. And that's been a huge thing. And at that, and part of our deal was we agreed to keep the House of Saud in power. And part of that included supporting Osama bin Laden and supporting the Mujahideen, which became Al-Qaeda, and not just supporting it financially, because the House of Saud could do that quite well, but supporting it militarily and through the CIA and in many other ways. And we've continued with that sort of a policy. You know, this whole dispute between the United States and Russia today about whether to keep Assad in power or not and how to deal with ISIS in that area is all part of this. And, you know, we've got to recognize that in a way Russia is much more threatened by ISIS than we are. After all, it's on Russia's borders. They're not very close to us, physically speaking, for the most part. But
you'd never know that to hear some people speak, would you?
No, absolutely not. And I think what's really important here is it's just another them. You know, this death economy that I talk about is so much based on fear, debt, the destruction of resources, and fear, you know. And the response to fear is to go deeper into debt by paying big corporations to build more military equipment to fight these wars. Let's face it, there's a lot of people gaining a lot more power and making a lot more money because of these wars in the Middle East. A lot of people, you and I may think we lost the Vietnam War, but a lot of people got very rich and powerful. Not a lot, actually, a handful of people got very rich and very powerful. And they're the people who are really calling the shots today. Wars empower, and wars make people rich.
It is about 20 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we invite your call right about now. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We are talking with John Perkins this morning, author of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman and several other works. He will be speaking at Powell's City of Books tonight, 10th and Burnside downtown at 7:30.
Yeah, and one of the things I'd like to point out is that one of the things I will be talking about in detail is how positive I am that we're going to change this. And we've been talking about a lot of negatives so far,
right. But
I'm very excited. I think there's a consciousness revolution that's sweeping the world right now. I travel around the world a great deal speaking, and I feel it everywhere I go. I think this may be the greatest revolution in history, bigger than the agricultural or industrial revolution or the American or French revolution. People are really waking up to the fact that we live on a fragile space station with no shuttles.
Oh, holla.
Yeah. We can't get off. And people are waking up to this. They're understanding it's a failed system. And now we've just got to encourage people to take action, to create this new reality, to change the story, to change the dream, however you want to look at it. And it's happening. But we've got to keep pushing for people to actually take actions and to realize that it's we, the people, who have to do it, that these corporations are controlling the world, but they're not inherently evil. They're just a story, too. They're just an imagined reality. And their reality is that they have to maximize profits, regardless of social and environmental costs. We've got to let them know that they need to pay a decent rate of return to their investors, because we need investors to create new technologies that no longer depend on ravaging the earth, that we can mine the plastic that's floating around out there in the Pacific instead of drilling for more oil and so many other things. So we need to pay investors a decent rate of return, but the main goal of corporations should be to serve a private interest and not to make a few wealthy people a lot wealthier. Serve a public interest.
Let's go ahead and talk to Sean, who has been holding for a while. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. In the early 70s, Kent State took place, of course, and then Fred Hampton was murdered, I think, in December of 69 in Chicago. The whole counterintelligence program was underway, and it seemed like we were on the verge of building a revolutionary movement in the United States, and it was brutally crushed. And then side by side with that, you have the propaganda of consumerism and all that. And I guess the point I'm getting to is that when I was a young college student in the early 90s, I remember cringing when Michael Parenti would defend state socialism. But now here I am 25 years later, and I hear you talk about a consciousness revolution, and I'm just asking myself, where is the leverage going to come from? And shouldn't we have gone back to that old state socialist model, the Vanguard Party model, to build an anti-capitalist movement that is going to get leverage for working people and poor people? I just don't see this consciousness expansion without concrete revolutionary movements. And if you have any comments on that, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Sean.
Yes, Sean. You've expressed it. Your consciousness has changed. You just said that, and I see this happening all over. And if we go back to that time in the '60s and the early '70s, Yes, to a certain degree, the movement was crushed, but also to a certain degree, we, and I was part of those the anti-Vietnam movement. I was a very big part of that movement, and also the racial integration movement. And in a way, we felt that we succeeded. The war ended, and it seemed as though we were making huge progress in racial integration. And so we all kind of said, okay, we won that one, and let's go on and
make, time to go to work.
Time to go to work. Exactly.
I was there too, I remember.
Yeah. And I think the difference is that in those days, we defined the problem as being Vietnam, racial discrimination. Those are symptoms. What we're beginning to see now is that the problem is totally systemic, and it's a global system. It's this death economy. It's an economy that's based on debt and fear and destroying the very resources upon which the economy depends. We're getting it. You're getting it. You're understanding it, and you're seeing the solution is getting rid of capitalism. And I think that what I more likely see is that the big corporations can be used in a positive way. They haven't been. We've got what Anna referred to as predatory capitalism, and I talk a lot about that. But what we need to do is channel these corporations to understand that their goal is to serve a public interest. And maybe ultimately we get rid of that system. I think maybe you're at an age where perhaps you can find a new system, you can create a new system. I'm 71. It's probably not going to happen in my lifetime. So what I'm trying to do is turn things around and use the corporations to turn things around. They're not evil. Except as we accept them as evil. You know, they've been acting evilly, but that's because we've allowed that to happen. You know, we've really said, we've sent the message out there, hey, I want cheap tennis shoes, well-made, good tennis shoes, and if those happen to be made by slaves in sweatshops in Indonesia, I'll just look the other way. I want cheap petroleum for my car, and if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, I'll just look the other way. We've been doing that, and we now need to turn that around and say, no, I expect you, every corporation I buy from, and use social media to do this. Send them the message, I'm not buying from you anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair wage, until you stop polluting the Amazon and the rest of the world. You know, get on social media. It's so powerful. We can change these corporations. We get rid of apartheid in South Africa by a few people boycotting corporations that supported it. We get corporations to clean up the rivers in this country that were terribly polluted. It only takes a small number of people, and social media makes that easier than ever. You're waking up in these years that you mentioned to this new consciousness is symbolic of a lot that's going on in the world. Now it's time to take action.
All right, 503-231-8187, the number to call. And you know, once a week is not enough. You can also like Positively Revolting on Facebook and follow along, or in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. I encourage you to do so. Let's go ahead and take another call. We have John on the air. Good morning, John.
Good name.
Isn't it? Good morning, John. Are you there?
Good morning. Great show, and really enjoying it. And seems to me that one of the major breakthroughs that we're all working on, all of us progressives, is equal rights for women all over the world, and followed by business opportunities. I know they had the micro banks. Are they still going to give, especially it was real successful with single women with or married women with children, to start their own businesses?
The microloan system, like in India, you're talking about?
Right. And I think it may be other places, mm-hmm. too.
Yes, all over the world mm-hmm. now, yes.
And then we could, it seems to me, we could make Planned Parenthood an international program. So we need to, in my opinion, and I'm sure many other people, hey, we need to get to zero population growth. Each one of us uses so many resources to live. And I'd really much rather have quality human beings than quantity.
Well, don't you think, John, that has to do with Americans use a lot of resources to live. People in other countries do not use as many resources.
Right, I agree. To live. I know in the suburbs,
they can have
people use a lot of resources, and I'm for the just replace yourself. And if you got to have more children, hey, there's plenty of kids out there that need homes, and they can adopt. Or
you know, as an adopted kid, I could go on for the next 3 days on that sentence right there. But let's not. And we'll probably, can you sort of wrap up? Because we do have a lot of other folks waiting.
That's my
okay.
It's interesting to hear you folks' comments.
So well, John, I would like to encourage you to pick one of those topics and really go after it. It's your passion, and every one of us has to follow our passion. So you know, don't give up on it, and don't just complain about it. Get out there, get on the internet, you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it takes. Every week, get everybody you know and ask them to contact everybody they know, and go after it. And that's what it's going to take for all of us to do that. You know, it's very easy to find fault with the system, but it's also pretty easy to change the system if we just get out there and do it. So I really, really encourage you to do that.
You know, I remember listening years ago to an interview. Somebody was being asked, you know, what's the most important issue? You know, the whole world, you know, this death cult, everything is not, you know, we're unsustainable. We've got all these problems economically, the criminal injustice system, all of this stuff. What's the most important issue? And the person who was being interviewed, I believe it was Winona LaDuke, said, the most important issue is the one that you have passion about.
I totally agree with that.
That there are so many fronts that need to be, you know, really that we need to advance in, that we need to really work with our passions, and because that's sustainable, that's going to let us go forward and power us through some very challenging times.
Yeah, I totally agree, but I would add to that that all of these are so important as long as they're leading to the same goal of creating a world that future generations will thank us for, creating a better world. You know, I often think of how grateful we should be that George Washington didn't try to write pamphlets and Tom Paine didn't try to lead armies. Washington had a passion and skills at leading men, and Paine had a passion and skills for writing pamphlets. Martha Washington had a passion and skills for organizing women to make clothes for the men at the forefront. They all took very different paths. They followed their passions, but they were headed toward the same destination of getting out from under the British yoke. We need to get out from under this predatory capitalist yoke, and we can take many, many different courses to do that. So John, who we just listened to, can go after one of these three subjects that he mentioned. Everybody has one, but let's all get out there and take action every single day.
Couldn't agree more. That's awesome. Let's talk to Mitch. Good morning, Mitch. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for having Mr. Perkins, and this is a wonderful conversation. I've spent most of my life trying to figure out how to shift certain paradigms, because just like the organizing principle of Mr. Perkins's book, The Economic Hitman, shifted the paradigms about these, because we were all, as Cold War children, impregnated with this idea that the United States uses its wealth to go around the world doing good.
For freedom!
And that's why it's so difficult to hear Mr. Perkins now, you know, the very term predatory capitalism was used without the word predatory in a very different way in our childhood, and he's right. There are two separate realities, if not more, at any given moment. But I want to resist the temptation to go macro with my concerns here, because Mr. Perkins made a very good point about how the Russians actually have a greater interest in attacking ISIS than we do because it's on their border. And this brings me to a paradigm that I don't see being shifted at all, because mass media has no interest in deepening the conversation. But we have pretty much accepted this, and here's what I don't understand. It's actually in the Europeans' interest to shift this paradigm, because Turkey is the linchpin of the Near East, and everything that used to be under the Ottoman Empire now went independent when the West broke up the Ottoman Empire. So we have a country of Syria, we have a country of Palestine, we have a Jewish state of Israel, we have the totally fictitious country of Jordan. We have one country after another that kind of grew out of the imperial deals that were made after World War One, and then certainly after World War Two, the ownership of those remote colonial operations shifted from the British to the Americans. But, you know, that problem with Syria, the auto-genocide in Syria, is a problem that is much closer to the Russian border, and I don't understand why the Europeans have not made an issue about, since Russia is contiguous with Europe, why hasn't there been a global outcry about the Russians being right after Jordan and Turkey in terms of taking the most refugees?
Whoa, that's a lot of things in one.
Let's sort of hold it there. Yeah. And John, what do you have to say?
Well, it's a lot. I think one of the things that we need to all recognize is that war works to the advantage of the very wealthy and powerful in the United States, Europe, and Russia, as well as in Iran and Syria and the rest of the world. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't think all these people get together in clandestine meetings. Most of them don't even know each other, but they all are driven by this.
They share a story, don't they?
They share a story of greed and the death economy. They believe that the way for them to succeed is to continue to support an economy that's based on ravaging the earth and on warfare, or the threat of warfare. We don't actually have to go to war, just have the threat of war, and then the Russians buy weapons, the Syrians buy weapons, the Israelis buy weapons, the Americans buy weapons, all the Europeans buy weapons, everybody buys weapons. And all the ancillary things that go along with producing weapons, the insurance companies benefit, Wall Street benefits, Coca-Cola benefits, everybody benefits when you steep up that economy. And so part of what's going on here is all of this posturing about war that brings a lot of money to the oligarchies of Russia, Europe, and the United States, and China, and so many other places. And I think it's really important for us to understand that and know that we've got to change that story. We've got to send out a message that we are one species, and there is no Russia, there is no China. There is no Germany. There is no United States. These are just fabricated borders that we've created through this imagined reality and codified into law. And now the wealthy and powerful keep telling the story of how they are the problem. And I was just interviewed by Russian TV recently, and they totally believe that the United States is out to get Russia. We won the Cold War. We sent our troops around the world anywhere where there's oil and gas. We've sent troops in, and the Russians are totally expecting us to send troops into Russia. That's their belief system. We have another belief system. But what we've all got to do is change that and come together and recognize that there's just one fragile planet, and it's a space station headed for disaster. We can't get off it. We need to turn it away from disaster. We all need to come together and create this life economy that'll benefit all of us across the planet.
I want to look at something rather the opposite from the life economy that you're talking about. Next week, we'll be turning our attention back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a subject that we talk about fairly often and hope to educate folks about. How do trade deals like the TPP or NAFTA or, WTO, all those, how does this factor in to the system that is currently? How do the economic hitman system, the jackals, all of that work around these trade deals?
Well, the trade deals are just emblematic. They're metaphors, and they're part of the policy of the economic hitman system. They bolster big corporations, there's no question. I spend a great deal of time in Latin America and in Central America. I speak Spanish, and I just came back, in fact, from Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Mexico. I was in all three of those countries during the month of January. And, one of the things we need to understand is what we call our immigration problem is really a NAFTA-CAFTA problem. These free trade agreements created a huge waves of immigrants, because what happened was these NAFTA and CAFTA, they'll say you can't have tariffs. Countries can't impose tariffs, but they say nothing about subsidies. So the United States subsidizes our big agribusinesses that produce corn and cotton. So here's an example. Let's say it costs about $5 per unit of corn to produce by an agribusiness in the United States, and a Mexican peasant can do it for $3. But the U.S. agribusiness gets a subsidy of $3. So in fact, they can sell their corn for $2.50 and make a half dollar profit, a pretty good decent profit on $2, whereas the Mexican peasant has to charge more than $3, even though he produces it more cheaply. So the Mexican peasant went out of business, could no longer support himself, and is emigrating to the United States. That's also true in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, throughout Central America. That's the immigration problem. At the same time, the big agribusinesses now have moved in and taken over the peasants' lands and are producing things like broccoli. You see broccoli all over parts of Mexico. The Mexicans don't eat much broccoli.
Flowers.
Flowers. Yeah, exactly. So many of these parts have been, so there's lands that used to support families, hundreds of thousands of families, now are supporting the big agribusinesses. Those families are without jobs. They're starving. Their men are coming here to work, and they're living miserable lives here. I talk to them. They're out there, you know, mowing our lawns and taking care of our houses.
People are sending their children.
Yeah, and they're living in very poor conditions here. 15 people in a small apartment.
If they live to get here.
Yeah, if they live
to
get
here. They can live through getting
here. And then they send their money back. They don't want to be here. Their countries are beautiful. They want to be back there, but there's no work for them. There's only starvation, and that's been created by NAFTA and CAFTA. And the TTP, TTIP and TPP will do the same things on a much larger basis. We're talking about half the world's population living under those two, maybe more than half the world's population. So we must not let that happen. We must recognize that the insidious nature of these free trade, they're not free trade at all.
Right. 503-231-8187, the number to call to join us in this conversation. We are talking with John Perkins this morning, the author of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Once again, John, you're going to be speaking tonight at Powell City of Books downtown.
Absolutely, and I'm so looking forward to meeting all of your listeners there, you know. And when I speak, I'm going to be talking a lot about what we all can do to turn this around. And the book, The New Confessions, has the whole last section is devoted to strategies for turning this around. Actually, lists of what students can do, retired people can do, people between retired and student can do, entrepreneurs can do, corporate executives can do, things we all can do. And I really want to get into that tonight and look forward to hearing from some of your people, too. So we'll open the floor to discussion at the end. And I so look forward to meeting your audience.
Fantastic. Let's see. Oh, my gosh. The bases are loaded. We have a lot of folks on the phone. Let's go ahead and take another call. I've got so many more questions. Let's talk to I think we're up to Harvey, right? Good morning, Harvey.
Hello, Lynn and Ani, and thank you, John, for your help putting America straight, helping straighten out America. If you Google the words India, WTO, and solar, it turns out that the World Trade Organization just ruled that India has to stop developing its own solar cells, and it has to buy American solar cells because that's a form of trade economic discrimination against American solar industry. And this will really slow solar development in India, where they really need it. I mean, millions of people die over the years over this dirty pollution. So the TTP is the WTO on steroids, and also the ruling shows the danger of posing more wide-ranging trade agreements, and like you said the TTP, the Trade and Service Agreement, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership will liberalize the trade of dirty fossil fuels and restrict government options from doing anything. So they've just done it to India, and this is right after the climate talks in Paris. It's so bad, it's unbelievable. So you can Google that. Once again, Google the words India, WTO, and solar, and all that information comes up.
All right. Thank you very much, George.
And I would just like to encourage you also to take action. Get out there and get on social media. Organize people to send emails, to write letters to their representatives, to their newspapers, to the corporations that are behind this. Take action. You know, it's great to point out these problems, but it's also really important that every single day, every one of us does something, no matter how small or how large.
350 PDX is having a training this Saturday. You can look things up on your whatever your favorite search engine is, and you will find here in Portland, 350.pdx. Yes, there's a lot to do. You know, the late, great John Trudell said, activist poet, that life's not about freedom, it's about responsibility. And that's something that, you know, the markets aren't free enough. That's something in America that has just been skewed, what freedom is about.
Right.
And certainly Native people get that it's about responsibility. As you were saying, leaving this wonderful blue ball better than we found it.
Mm-hmm. Much, much better.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of work to do on that one, baby.
Let's go ahead and talk to Jenny. Good morning, Jenny. Good morning.
Jenny, are you there?
Perhaps we've caught Jenny by surprise. We'll check back in just a moment. Good morning, George. George, are you there?
Hello?
Oh, Jenny?
Sounds like Jenny. Jenny, is that you?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I pressed the wrong button.
It's okay. And good morning, and you're here now.
You're on the air.
Thank you so much for your patience. So with respect to the Mexico and the economy and NAFTA particularly, the guest, I am interested in those politics and the economies, and I was wondering if you could comment on the element of the drug cartels in the economy, because as I read the news out of Mexico from the journalists and the writers, you know, fiction writers and so on, I see that overwhelmingly they're preoccupied with the violence from the drug cartels. And I was just wondering if you could comment how that impacts the economies that we're talking about right now. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks very much, Jenny, for your question.
Sure.
Well, thanks, Jenny. Yeah, you know, I was just in Mexico. I was speaking at a big writers' conference there in San Miguel de Allende, and most of Mexico isn't affected. You know, I didn't feel any threat there. The border areas are, and I think, unfortunately, we in the United States once again have to take tremendous responsibility for the drug problems of Latin America. We're the buyers. You know, we are the consumers here. There's not that many drugs consumed in Latin America. I spend a lot of time throughout that whole region, speak the language fluently, and also we also have to recognize that our CIA and NSA are to a large degree complicit in the drug trade. They make a lot of money off it. This goes back a long time. The opium wars in Asia that were conducted by the Secret Service of the British Empire started this. And during the Vietnam War, the Golden Triangle, those were CIA operations. The Iran-Contra deal was supported to a large degree by drug trafficking and as well as weapons trafficking. And today we're seeing that here. I don't know this for sure from personal experience, but I've heard from my Colombian and Mexican friends both that the reason that the drug trafficking has moved from Colombia to Mexico, and I was in Colombia in December, I was in Mexico in January, is because Pablo Escobar was and the people that succeeded him, that followed him, was really tied in with the CIA, and there was a complicit agreement there. And when his operation began to fail, when it went down, when he was killed, and it went down, suddenly that control was lost. And so there was an intent to shift it to Mexico, where the CIA and others had more control and continue to have control. Anyway, it's a long story of how much money we make off gun trafficking in these countries. The CIA makes off gun trafficking as well as off drug trafficking. And we need to, again, once to understand that the problem is here in the United States, the consumption of these drugs. It isn't about those countries. They're being terribly exploited and victimized by this whole process.
Yeah, I think it's also important just to emphasize your first point that it is not ubiquitous throughout the country of Mexico, regardless of what you might see in the press.
Yeah, thanks, Ani, for saying that. I've traveled around Mexico a lot, very, very safely. In fact, I feel safer in Mexico than I do in many parts of the United States.
And that said,
that's
I did
how
hear.
We feel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely in Jalisco. Anyway, I have heard, however, recently that Veracruz is about the most dangerous spot on the planet right now for journalists. And more journalists are being killed in Veracruz, actually reporting on corruption than any other spot on Earth right now.
Then, Ani, please stay away.
I will be not going to Veracruz anytime really? Soon. Anyways, let's go ahead and, oh my gosh, so many people.
Jorge.
Well, they can come to tonight, too, if they don't get on here. Ask me tonight
That's right.
At Powell's Bookstore if and they don't get on today. And even if you do come.
Excellent point. Let's go ahead and see if George is there. Good morning, George.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning, John. My name is George, as you know. I've read your books, and I'm calling with an invitation. Do you know Dr. Peter Bechtel?
I It sounds familiar, but Bechtel's the name that is familiar to me. I don't know, George. Go ahead. Who is he?
He's a professor at Middle East Studies at Portland State University, and he's going to present a talk today on ISIS from 1 to 3 p.m. at Portland Community College. And if you would care to join us, I'm sure I can weave you into the program.
That's a
kind of three. I'll pick you up and bring you back and all that sort of thing.
I would so love to, but I've got another commitment. It's a little bit late of an invitation. I just arrived in Portland last night, and I leave tomorrow after speaking at Powell's tonight. So I'm very committed. Unfortunately, let me know next time that comes up. Go to my web.
I was afraid of that. I thought you would probably
go to my website, johnperkins.org. Sign up for my newsletter, and contact me.
Okay.
Thanks very much, George.
Take care.
I want to talk to you just for a moment about that question that has often come up. And it's, you write in Confessions of an Economic Hitman that once you were sort of introduced to that system, you were told that if you accept this, you're in for life.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you had a change of heart,
mm-hmm.
and you left.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have the question, how is it that you're still alive?
Maybe I'm just an imagined reality. That's a very good question. And I go into detail in the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman about that. But the short version is that I started writing the book to expose this system back in the early 80s after I left being an economic hitman. And I contacted other people that had my type of job and immediately got anonymous phone calls threatening my life and that of my infant daughter. At the same time, I got invited out to dinner by the chairman of the board of Stone & Webster, a big consulting firm in Boston that had been a rival of my company. And he said, you know, you've got a great resume. Yes, I'd been chief economist at one of his main competitors. He said, we'd like to use your resume in proposals. You won't have to do any work for us. And just let us use your resume, and I'm prepared to write you a check for $500,000 consultant's retainer. Just don't write the book. And so my life's being threatened, my daughter's life's being threatened by people I have seen. The jackals, I had seen them kill two of my clients, the president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, and the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos. I took them very seriously. I'm being offered a bribe. What would you do?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I took the money, and in my own defense, I'd say I didn't go out and buy a fancy house or fast cars or something. I put the money into going back to countries I'd screwed, and I formed a couple of nonprofits, Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance. I co-founded with Bill and Lynn Twist. You go to my website, johnperkins.org, and you can link to those and find out more about those organizations. And I wrote books about indigenous people, Shapeshifting, The World is As You Dream It. These are available also now. And Stone & Webster was okay with that. I didn't write the book, you know. And when 9/11 happened, I was in the Amazon. My contract with Stone & Webster had expired. And when I came home, I flew to ground zero. As I stood there looking into that smoldering pit, I knew I had to write this book. I had to expose what I knew about our system. But I decided I wouldn't contact anybody else. It would not be an expose. It would be a personal confession. And I wrote the whole book, got it in the hands of a very good New York agent who got it out to publishers. At that point, it became my insurance policy. It still is. This new book is my insurance policy, because any self-respecting jackal who might want to see me not tell the story knows that the worst thing they can do is kill me. The book sales will skyrocket. And incidentally, the book yesterday, the new book, The New Confessions, went to number one on several categories on Amazon. But it would skyrocket on every category if I walk out of the studio and somebody shoots me. My publishers will probably
let us not speculate about the success of your publishers at that point.
Yeah. Well, and some people have gone to jail. Some people have, there's Snowden and Chelsea Manning have, Snowden's banished, Chelsea Manning's in jail. Other CIA people have gone to jail. So is this your insurance policy for that?
Well, some people tried to put me in jail. I got very nasty letters from lawyers for Bechtel, the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and other organizations. But I had lots of backup data. And I sent them, and my publisher sent them copies of the backup data along with a letter saying, not only will we not rescind what we said, which is what they'd asked me to do in the next edition,
right.
In the next edition, we will say that you're extorting us, And everything that I said, I could prove. I have backup information. The New York Times did a pretty thorough vetting and did a major article back in 2005, 2006 on the book. So those who tried to sue me, who tried to send me to jail, went away when they saw the evidence that I had to support what I write about.
Let's go ahead and talk to Sunny. Good morning, Sunny. You're on the air.
Wow, what a fight. What a fight. I mean, just listening to what this fellow has gone through and to, you know, and lived. Interesting. When you were talking about the other isms, I wanted to bring in target isms because you also mentioned the NSA and the CIA, and we know that they're all through the phone lines already. You know, that's what Snowden is hiding out in Russia for, you know. And the thing is that when people participate in targetism, and we know what it is, it's somebody's identified as saying the wrong things. A lot of stuff can be taken out of context. A lot of things can be spliced and diced. A lot of stuff can be picked up by gang members next door that are sitting on someone's internet or phone lines also. This is old, old story. And those who participate in targetism and targeting, they get some juicy piece of information that comes up in their email or somehow, some way about somebody, and then they all start working on them. They are enemies of freedom. They are traitors. And whatever a person thinks that they know about someone, do they really know until they really know that person? And I'm saying that this sort of tactic is being used to entirely shred and destroy good people's lives. Oftentimes, our strongest freedom fighters are
absolutely
being hit terribly. And John Trudell was a victim of this before he passed on to the next world. And I appreciated also your mentioning George Washington and the other people associated around the beginnings of the formal nation construct that we live in at this time. I think that there's a meeting place between traditionalist freedom thinkers who want to stick with their guns, and I think that's a good idea. And also the more progressive, you know, we've got to also enter a sustainable world. I think that there is a meeting place here, and we've got to find it, but we must not participate in any level of targetism, which is often also forwarded by secret societies.
We're gonna have to sort of end it there because we're out of time, Sunny. Yeah.
But thanks for your call.
Lynn.
Yes.
So thank you. I love your listeners, you guys. You know,
we have great listeners, don't we?
My God, yeah. So in the comments, and I'm really looking forward to meeting some of these people tonight because I think your listeners have so much to say, and it's a great opportunity for them to say. And that is what as Sunny just pointed out, that's what freedom is all about. You know, speaking up and getting involved and taking action. And we must do that. And thank you. Thank you very much.
And so one more time tonight, John Perkins will be speaking at Powell City of Books downtown. That's at 10th and Burnside at 7:30. So if you have
been there or be square,
if you've been waiting to ask your question on the air, we are sadly out of time for that. And so you'll have to just go to Powell's tonight and ask those questions and engage in dialogue there. John, any final words? We've got about 2 minutes left before we must vacate the studio.
You know, I just like to say that I thank you for this program, you know, and for all you're doing to this revolution, you know, waking people up. And I think we're living in the most fantastic time in human history. This is the biggest revolution we've ever experienced. I used to wish I'd grown up in the 1770s to be part of the American Revolution. This is a bigger revolution. It's global. And it's a lot more comfortable. The bathrooms are better.
Well, for some people.
The beds are better.
For
you
some
know?
People, yes.
The communication is much easier. You know, we've got these microphones. We've got the internet. And I think this is a blessed time to be alive. We need to have fun with this. We need to understand that the revolution is fun. We don't need to burn out. We need to enjoy it. Everybody needs to follow their passion. Mine is writing and speaking like tonight at Powell's and getting to know people. I love doing that. But other people, you know, whether you're a dentist and you talk to someone when your hand's in their mouth, or whether you're a parent who brings your child up, or whatever you do, follow your passion and let's all move to that same goal of creating an environmentally sustainable and regenerative world, and a socially just world, one that the future generations of all species will thank us for passing on to them.
John Perkins, author of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, thank you so much for joining us in studio this morning.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
All right.
And we'll be back next week talking about the TPP. The saga continues.
And why it doesn't work for anyone.
Cheers.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 39th Annual Portland International Film Festival hosted by the Northwest Film Center. 97 feature films and 62 short films from all over the world will be playing through February 27th, all over Portland. There are also special focus programs, including Global Classroom, a Made in Oregon shorts program, PIFF After Dark, again. That's the 39th Annual Portland International Film Festival, screening films at multiple locations throughout Portland until February 27th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, March 8th from midnight to midnight as we celebrate International Women's Day with 24 hours of programming produced, hosted, and engineered by women. There will be live music, public affairs with a feminist focus, and female DJs playing all kinds of music to celebrate the creativity, variety, and zeal of the women of the world. Again, that's Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.